Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Toyota? Yeah, it's still in trouble. Healthcare? It's still really expensive. The Dow above 10,000? Yeah, not by so much. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. You can build a team online at elance.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is the 4th of February today. This one is a Thursday, and it is good to have you with us. This is going to be one of the rare days we start with a raw news item. No context, no analysis, just what happened. Today was not a good day for stocks, not here, not anywhere on the global exchanges, really. All three major indices in New York were down close to 3%, almost 270 points on the Dow Jones Industrial Average. All right. So I fibbed. Here's just a little bit of analysis. There are some worries about sovereign debt over in Europe, Greece, Spain, and Ireland in particular. Also, nobody is real confident about the January unemployment report that we are going to get tomorrow morning. On the Toyota story today, there were some new developments. American safety regulators have opened a formal investigation into problems with the brakes on Priuses. That is, of course, the world's best-selling hybrid. So far, the company hasn't stopped selling them, as it has eight other models with faulty gas pedals. But farther down the corporate ladder, Toyota dealers, the ones stuck with all that inventory hanging around, not making money, they're also having to fix the cars that customers are bringing in. And Brett Neely reports from a Toyota dealership in Silver Spring, Maryland, that they are not exactly having the times of their lives.
The showroom of the Dar Cars Toyota had no customers earlier today, but the back office of this D.C. area dealership looked like a war room. Takeout boxes litter the place, and newspaper clippings about Toyota were tacked to the wall. Further back in the service center, mechanics replaced defective gas pedals.
After you install the bolts, you connect the connector, remove the electrical tape, and make sure the pedal's functioning properly after the bolts are in and tight.
Toyota has recalled more than 7 million cars. Today, the carmaker said the recalls could cost it 100,000 sales this year. For dealers like Dar Cars, that's a big hit. Tammy Darvish heads up sales here and has been working 18-hour days. She says customers haven't given up on Toyota.
Everyone that we've spoken to, I've not had one tell me, I refuse to drive my car anymore, I don't want this car, help me get out of it, or anything like that.
But a few steps away, in the service center, some Toyota owners like Desiree Payne were rattled. She isn't planning to get rid of her car, but she's not sure she'll ever buy a Toyota again.
I would definitely have second thoughts.
Back in the empty showroom, the sales staff looked nervous. They said business has cratered since the recalls. One salesman blamed the government for helping Toyota's competitors, General Motors and Ford. Yesterday, Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood said owners of the recalled models should stop driving them. Then he backtracked. Salesman Brian Thompson.
Government is majority owner in GM. You don't think they need to sell their product? Why are their sales up 12% from last year? Come on now. This is nothing more than the government pushing people around.
I asked sales chief Tammy Darvish if the dealership would offer incentives to customers. Toyota traditionally offers fewer and sells cars on the basis of higher prices for higher quality.
No, I mean, there's no reason for us to incentivize because of a recall.
Darvish is convinced these problems will get fixed and go away. In Silver Spring, Maryland, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
Back during the height of the healthcare debate, President Obama had a line he liked to use when he was out making speeches, that doing nothing to stop rising costs, the president would say, was actually doing something. It was choosing to let those costs take over virtually the entire economy. We learned this morning how true that might turn out to be. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, that's the agency that runs those programs, it reported today that we spent $2.5 trillion on medical care last year, and that taxpayers are footing more of that bill than anybody had thought. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Gregory Warner has more.
A lot of this year's jump in government share of the spending is due to the recession. The weak economy pushed more people off private insurance and onto Medicaid. But look beyond the recession bump, and the message of this year's numbers is the same as last year's. Chris Truffer co-wrote the report for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
The fundamentals that have been driving healthcare spending growth, we project, are going to still be fairly similar as the recession ends.
Translation, every year we're using more healthcare, and every year we're paying more for it. It's a bigger share of the economy, now more than one in every $6. That means healthcare premiums will keep rising. More people with plans will lose them, and more tax dollars will go to healthcare. Henry Aaron is a fellow at the Brookings Institution.
It would mean steadily increasing pressure on public budgets. And if those budgets are not managed effectively, that could create very serious problems economically for the nation.
If this doesn't sound like a new alarm, it's not. Buzz Cooper is a professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania.
This time, the fear that the economy will implode may be real. The problem is that it's been forecasted so many times.
He says even the most optimistic proposals on the table for healthcare reform would not stop the rising cost.
So we're on a course of increasing healthcare spending, and we're going to get there sometime.
There being the point where we can no longer afford to stay on that course. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Change can be hard, as the healthcare debate has shown. For a company, it can be really costly, especially a company whose iconic product is a household name. Heinz is doing it anyway. Not only is the company reducing the sodium in its ketchup and introducing a version of with sugar instead of high fructose corn syrup, it's also replacing those little packets you find in cafeterias and takeout places with a new, seriously now, ketchup delivery vehicle, a packet they call Dip and Squeeze. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Heinz introduced the little foil squeeze packet at fast food restaurants in 1968.
The complaint started in 1969.
Dave Szczynski is Heinz's VP for ketchup.
It was too small, too hard to open, and too messy.
Szczynski says the new plastic packet is shaped like a bottle, holds three times as much, and allows the consumer
to dip, just like a traditional dip cup, but at the same time, you can tear the top, and it allows consumers to squeeze if they want to put it on top of, let's say, a hamburger, for example.
Heinz seems to be taking a mea culpa and saying, we've been giving you a bad service, now we're going to give you a good one.
Brett Thorne is food editor at Nation's Restaurant News. He says the new packaging fits better with consumer behavior these days.
So they want to decide how much ketchup they're going to put on and what else they want to add to their food. Sprinkling things on it and pouring things, everybody likes that.
Ultimately, Heinz wants to boost sales to fast food chains. Michael Stern co-authors the Road Food series. He thinks this will entice people to eat more ketchup in one venue, behind the wheel. But he anticipates some bumps in the road.
If I put that on my dashboard and dip a French fry into it, I like a lot of ketchup. Chances are very good the weight of the ketchup and the French fry together are going to actually yank the dip and squeeze container off my dashboard and onto my lap.
Next, better mousetrap on the condiment front, a dashboard holder for ketchup. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Oh, man, and you thought Toyota had problems. Anyway, you know the broad outlines of the day on Wall Street. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Just as businesses and nonprofits and interest groups have realized the power of social networking, so too has the government in a whole lot of different ways. Politicians have their pages. The army goes online to recruit, just for instance. But sometimes the motives aren't quite so straightforward. It is not clear what rules, if any, state or federal agencies have to follow when they try to friend you. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
Uncle Sam wants you to be his friend. The government is friending people on Facebook, monitoring Twitter, and generally chatting up citizens on social networks. But what if your new friend is with the CIA and using a fake identity? Are there rules for undercover agents who use social networks to get information? Marsha Hoffman would like to find out.
We kept reading these anecdotes about law enforcement using this information in certain investigations, and we just kind of wondered, is this something that's really been very well thought out?
Hoffman is a lawyer with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a public interest group focused on privacy issues. The foundation sued the CIA, Justice, and Defense Departments after reading reports that the CIA is monitoring social media sites like Twitter. Hoffman says her group wants to find out if there are any rules in place. She says social networking is like a new frontier.
New things come along, and it takes time for society to decide how to use them and what is acceptable and what's not acceptable.
Like, is it okay for government tax collectors to dig around social networking sites looking for possible tax cheats? Minnesota tax agents did just that using MySpace. The tax dodger announced on the site that he was moving to a new job and gave the name of his employer. That helped the tax agents track him down. Clifford Fishman is a law professor at Catholic University in Washington. He says the government should be able to use social networking sites to catch people breaking the law. But here's where he draws the line.
The government should not inquire into somebody's religious or political activities, even if that is part of a person's profile on MySpace, for example. That ought not to be something the government should save or accept in highly unusual circumstances look for.
But Fishman says there are legitimate government uses of social networking sites, like the Army's Facebook page and chat rooms. They're very open. You know your friends are in uniform. Suzanne Nagel heads the Army's online recruiting efforts.
We have to fish where the fish are.
Nagel says recruiters wouldn't be doing their jobs if they didn't go on social networking sites for prospective soldiers.
They're reading blogs, they're following Twitter, they're doing all these different things, and that's why we're doing social networking.
But the Pentagon doesn't have any rules on use of social networking sites. Professor Fishman says government agencies should police themselves, and he says the Justice Department shouldn't reveal much about those regulations because that could compromise undercover agents. Hoffman, the lawyer with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, says the government should be upfront or face the legislative consequences.
If at some point in the future there was ever a feeling that these agencies collect information inappropriately, I'm sure that Congress could pass a law to try to regulate it.
Until then, keep in mind that basic information you put online, like having a new job or where you went on vacation, can say a lot about you. Maybe too much. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Not even mighty Apple could withstand the selling on Wall Street today. Shares of the music and gadget company gave up 3.6% this afternoon, although it is a pretty safe bet that they will pop right back up as the release date for the iPad draws near. But even Apple's latest toy isn't without controversy. Many of its hugely popular devices, the iPhone, the iPod, and the soon-to-be-released Pad, they don't run Flash. That's a web tool that lets you run almost every bit of animation you see online. Videos, games, ads, all that stuff. Not using Flash does seem counterproductive. I mean, why would Apple want to make it harder to use the internet, right? Commentator Farhad Manju has a couple of ideas on that.
What was Steve Jobs thinking? 85 of the top 100 most popular sites use Flash to display content like videos or games or slideshows. If you go to those sites with the iPad, you're likely to see an error icon instead. One explanation? Apple is just being smug, which is nothing new for Apple. Like the iPhone before it, the iPad will be completely locked down, meaning it won't run any programs that Apple doesn't approve of. And Apple has said that Flash is riddled with errors. In other words, Steve Jobs isn't going to ruin his pristine machine just so you can watch Hulu. But Apple could also be making a wise bet about the future of the web. Many web browsers are adopting a new standard to make websites interactive, HTML5. That's the code that powers the web, and the new version will allow sites to play videos without the need for any pesky plugins. Several huge video sites, including YouTube, have embraced it. What's more, HTML5 video works just fine on the iPhone, and it'll work on the iPad, too. Jobs has a track record of knowing when technologies are on the way out. When Apple launched the iMac in 1998, it didn't include a floppy drive. The tech press cried foul. How could a computer not include a floppy? Jobs predicted we'd use the internet to move our data instead. And he was right. Steve Jobs is making the same kind of prediction now. He's guessing web companies are going to ditch Flash in favor of HTML5. And if the iPad's a hit, websites will feel the push to become iPad compatible anyway. In the end, Apple wins. The company gets to keep its rival's technology away from the iPad, and owners won't see all those error icons. So maybe Steve Jobs isn't that crazy after all. Just crazy like a fox.
Farhad Manju covers technology for Slate. Take a minute to send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Coming up, dispatches from the underemployed.
I have employers that say, don't send me anyone that's unemployed, because they think good employees are not laid off.
But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, if ever there was a day for the wah-wah trombones, this is it. The Dow Industrials tumbled 268 points today, more than 2.5%, landed just barely above the five-digit mark, 10,002 at the bell. The Nasdaq dove 65 points, nearly 3%, 21.25 at the close. The S&P 500 dropped 34 points, 0.3%, wrapped up trading at 1,063. Spooked investors rushed to buy dollars. That helped commodity prices fall. Shares of mining giant Rio Tinto caved in more than 6% today. Elsewhere, retailers released January sales figures today. Macy's did better than expected, sent shares up the escalator 2.5%. Meantime, number two discounter Target rang up disappointing shares. Shares fell more than 3%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to updates on the economy and business, watch the Marketplace whiteboards, and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports on the employment situation for January. Dentists across the country provide free services to children from low-income families during the annual Give Kids a Smile program, sponsored by the American Dental Association. And these kids may soon need a dentist. It's Bubblegum Day. Kids raise money for charity by paying to chew gum in school. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. There is no shortage of books about the financial crisis. No shortage at all, really. And there are a couple of good ones, but the better part of the ones I've seen are a tad dry, kind of tough to get through. That might be because they were written by people who aren't really writers, at least in the true storytelling sense. John Lanchester, though, is a storyteller. He's a fiction writer who's written a true-life story of what happened to the global banking system over the past couple of years. It's called IOU. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
You are a novelist by inclination, right?
I am.
Yet this is a distinctly non-fiction book. I mean, this is the events of the day. How'd you come to write it?
Well, it's a sort of mutant outgrowth of a novel, in a sense, that I was been working on a book for a few years, and so I'd been reading up on financial things as background to the novel I was writing, and then after a few months of that, the British bank Northern Rock blew up, and there was a run on the bank, the first one since the 19th century, and I just, you know, the subject slightly took over from the novel, and I've ended up writing this non-fiction book about it.
Your father was a banker. You grew up in the shadow of finance, I think it could fairly be said. And you tell a great story about how your awareness of money actually started with an automated teller machine, an ATM.
This was in Hong Kong in the early 1970s. The first ATM in Hong Kong was actually at the foot of the bank. And I remember my father using it, and I found it absolutely terrifying. There's something about the way the machine just kind of coughed up money with no difficulty. And I was very preoccupied by the idea that, you know, he'd accidentally take too much out, or it would take it out of the wrong account and we'd get in trouble, or, you know, that we didn't actually have that much money. There just seemed the frictionlessness, you know, the ease with which money just flowed out into the world from this machine just completely freaked me out. And I used to mercilessly, you know, I used to beg my father not to take cash out, and he kind of grimly sat there tapping in his PIN number while I wept on his arm.
That's a great word, actually, frictionlessness, because that's really sort of what happened, the cause of this whole thing, right? I mean, money was moving all over the place and nobody really knew it.
Yeah, I think that is it. And it's strange how easy it is for that to seem natural. It's almost a trick of rebranding, you know. They don't so much call it money, they call it credit. Once upon a time, credit used to be called debt, which is what it is. But if you rename money as credit and give people the idea that access to credit is something that is almost a right, it's something that should be easy, that should be freely available, that shouldn't really have consequences, I think it becomes much easier to, you know, jam people with all the debts that they got stuck with.
So as you wrote the final pages of this book, what was it that you had in your mind that you wanted readers to get out of it? I mean, you tell a story and you go into some detail, but where does that leave us?
There is such a big gap between the world of money and people who say the word interest rates, and they automatically know that that means a whole set of things linking inflation, employment, balance of payments, exports, you know, mortgages going up. And there's an awful lot of us who don't quite speak finance or speak money. One of my real ambitions for the book was to narrow that and to talk across that gap, and for people to have got to the end of the book feeling, okay, I'm sufficiently well informed about how we got here to be able to think clearly and informedly and for myself about the road forward.
John Lanchester, his most recent book, decidedly not a work of fiction, is called IOU, Why Everyone Owes Everyone and No One Can Pay. John, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you very much, Kai.
I mentioned as we got going today that the January jobs report is going to come out tomorrow. The official unemployment rate will probably be somewhere within a couple of decimal points of 10%. But there is a whole other group of people out there who are holding on to work by a thread. They are called underemployed, people who've been laid off and who can now only find part-time jobs or fewer hours. If you count them, the full measure of slack in the labor market is closer to 20%. From WCPN in Cleveland, Dan Bobkoff reports.
All right, thank you so much. Okay.
Pam Jaguer has long worked in human resources. These days, she's working just 20 hours a week at a staffing agency in Brunswick, Ohio, called the Reserves Network. It's not an ideal situation, but her new bosses, Kent McNichol and Marilyn Sendry, definitely appreciate her help.
We can take advantage of her expertise.
She's educated, she's skilled.
Quite an asset to us right now in her role.
The Reserves Network, this is Pam.
Jaguer ended up here after she lost her job at an auto parts producer at the height of the recession.
On tax day, April 15th, I was downsized.
As an HR person, she knew what to expect.
That I would probably be asked to leave right away, and it was just very shocking, very, very shocking.
So she gathered her things and called her connections at the Reserves Network, which had been her client.
They knew I was looking, and Marilyn said, "I'll watch for any opportunity. We'd love to have you work in our office."
It took a few months, but the agency found her a part-time gig. She now helps the team place temp workers. But it's really an entry-level position and a huge drop in income.
It's enormous. not even 50%.
That puts Pam Jaguer among the nearly 9 million Americans who are underemployed. They're still working, but only part-time.
Not only do they receive this large cutback in hours, but we also find that these individuals also take large cuts in their pay, so their hourly wage also falls.
Andrew Sum is a labor economist at Northeastern University in Boston. He says underemployment has more than doubled in the last 2 years, a bigger rise than at any time since World War II.
This is far greater than that of any of the previous five recessions that we had in the U.S. So this problem has become extraordinarily intense.
Sum says there are two kinds of underemployment. employees still working at the same company but with their hours drastically cut back, or those like Pam Jaguer. They were laid off and could only get part-time work.
That group is the one that typically undergoes the large wage decline.
But experts say finding some work, even if it's beneath you, can help long-term. Deborah Stitt is a recruiter in Cleveland.
People are really taking a step back, saying, okay, you know, 10 years ago I did that. I can do that again.
With so many people both out of work and underemployed, Stitt says companies can be harsh.
I have employers that say, don't send me anyone that's unemployed. Don't want to talk to them. And right or wrong, that's the thinking, because they think good employees are not laid off.
Pam Jaguer holds out hope that continuing to work in her field, even for low pay, will help make her more attractive to potential employers.
The good thing is I know that it all takes time. I know that they are overwhelmed with resumes, and people without skills apply for your jobs, and it's very, very overwhelming, and that it does take time, and it is disheartening.
After all those years in HR, she knows how it works on both sides. In Cleveland, I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
Find out where your state ranks on the list of most people underemployed. You can check out our new online feature, The Daily Nugget, it's called, and it's on our homepage, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note before we go, the financial crisis has hit a lot of people hard, of course, including New York restaurateurs who count on bankers and traders for a good part of their business. So one of them, Smith & Walensky's on 3rd Avenue in Manhattan, is trying something new.
I mean, as long as they bring in an original stock certificate and a separate stock power with signature and a medallion, they're good to go.
That's Michael Stillman. He runs the company that manages the New York Smith & Walensky's. And the idea is pretty easy. No cash needed. They'll trade stock certificates for food. Not all shares are created equal, though.
You know, it really depends on what stock, and we're actually trying to coordinate which stocks might buy which things. And we've been doing a little research, and there may be something up on our website soon that you can tally.
We asked Mr. Stillman about one of the weaker of the big banks, Citigroup, a share of which could be had for $3.18 today.
I would say Citi might be a half a baked potato. But Goldman will still buy you a nice porterhouse or three.
Half a baked potato, best line ever. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow plunged 268 points, more than 2.5%. The NASDAQ dipped 65 points, nearly 3%. The S&P 500 down 34 points, 0.3%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune in tomorrow morning to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And tomorrow afternoon, on this radio show, bosses go undercover to better understand their employees.
Anything that any of us can do to just better understand and open the channels of communication, it can only be a positive thing.
Unless it's bosses getting in the way, I don't know. Anyway, I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.